Excellent. We'll come to order. Senator Scogin, are you around? There you are, Senator Scogin. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee. We'll be adding Lisa Lindberg as a testifier today. I apologize. We didn't know that she'd be able to make it because of the weather and her schedule, but she did make it. So Deb Carpenter joins me as well. Committee, you're looking at Senate file.
Senator Scogin, you know that when freshmen come in front of a committee for the first time, normally they buy a round, okay? So just so you know.
Senator Tomasoni, if you would then take names
and
make sure I don't miss anybody later.
I just want to make sure you know.
I appreciate that.
One of those initiation things, you know.
And I don't need these, but I'm going to put them on for just a second. Committee, if you'd look to Senate File 717. Northern Connections is a productive and proactive outbound communication center. It blends the best of technology with high-touch, intensive human services efficiently provided by skilled professionals. Customers of Northern Connections are those that are moving out of the public funding to financial self-sufficiency in 9 counties in west central Minnesota. Northern Connections fills a void that's left by the traditional workforce systems and provides supportive services to improve the self-sufficiency success rate. Services provided include counseling on reemployment, job retention, career advancement, and asset accumulation. Having said that, I will turn things over to Deb Carpenter, who has been involved in the first year of Northern Connections. Deb, for the committee, would you please identify yourself?
Thank you, Senator. Welcome, Ms. Carpenter.
I'm Deborah Carpenter. I'm Executive Director of Northern Connections. And as Senator Scogin mentioned, we're in Pahrump, Minnesota. We provide services for 9 counties in west central Minnesota. We work with individuals who have gone off of cash assistance in the Minnesota Family Investment Program or Diversionary Work Program. So at the point that they no longer get cash assistance, we receive their name from the Department of Human Services and we contact people. It's a voluntary program. We've had good participation rates from individuals in terms of choosing to work with us in the program. And what we work with individuals on is trying to improve the odds that they'll be successful in that transition to self-sufficiency. We know in the 9-county area, as in many other parts of Minnesota, about 1/3 of the individuals go back on Minnesota Family Investment Program within 1 year. In North Carolina, where our program was originally developed and we built the program off the model in North Carolina, they were able to reduce that to 10% or less in the counties where they were working with people. So we work with them on employment issues, job retention issues. So how do we alleviate the chance that the job won't work through working through the issues that people typically encounter in a new job and making sure that they have a higher success rate in that job? We work on career advancement. How do we help people build skills that will move them into higher wage jobs over a period of time? Because it's going to be things like on-the-job training or additional training that they're able to receive that will help them move up into higher wage jobs in the future, and then help them get assets accumulated. First, looking at what their credit history is and doing some credit restoration if that's necessary, and many times that is necessary. Getting them plugged into programs like the Families for Independence in Minnesota program, the FAME program, where they do the individual development account so that there's some match savings to either go back to school or buy a house or start a small business. So getting them plugged into programs like that that can help them build assets, and getting them connected to mainstream checking or savings programs so that they can begin to budget and save dollars. So we work with individuals telephonically because we find that's more efficient. We know that the types of goals that we're working with individuals on aren't met in a couple months. It's going to take, you know, 12 to 24 months for people to meet those kinds of goals that they're setting, because they're, you know, they're goals that take time and a lot of effort to be able to attain. So we work with them over that period of time, calling them on a regular basis. Doing it telephonically, we're able to eliminate the barriers of transportation, childcare, time, and really give people more time and attention than we could do in a face-to-face type of system. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Lisa's here. Lisa's participated in our program since September when we began and can answer questions and talk about her experience with the program.
Quorum is present. Ms. Carpenter, I think you got $250,000 last year.
We did.
And it was a pilot program last year. Do you want it to also be a pilot program again this year, or do you want this to be a permanent program?
No. The evaluation isn't complete at this point in time, so I think it still is considered a pilot program in Minnesota. It's proven itself in North Carolina, but it has not proven itself here in Minnesota.
Okay. And would you like to say anything?
Lisa Lindberg. I've been a part of this program for 6 months since September. I speak to a woman, Robin, on a weekly basis. She has helped me a lot in information on helping, like I said, with my credit report. I've done that, and I've the FAME program, which is a account with the government. She just gives me a lot of information on how to step out there and be productive and be more confident in myself. Accept downfalls when they happen, but step out there and grab them when it's given to me, my opportunities here that they have given me. Ideas through my work, you know, how to deal with stress and everything at work, how to do it on a good basis, you know, so I keep a good foundation with my work and stepping, you know, into career, like my GED. She's been working with me, encouraging me to take my GED. To better myself as well, because further down the line, I would like to get into some type of counseling schooling. The first home, she's helping me with the first homeowners loan, information on that. They're just really, they go above and beyond giving me information. They do it on a personal level as well, you know, and they care when we make it, and they care when we don't make it. They've just been real helpful to me.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there any questions? One other question, Ms. Carpenter. Last year there was a match, I think a dollar-for-dollar match. That's not in this particular legislation. Is that purposeful, or do you want to have a match in this legislation?
We will have a match. We've already raised $215,000 for next fiscal year, which begins 7/1, and we have a couple other grants that we've applied for that we're waiting to hear on. So will have a match.
Do you want that inserted in this legislation?
I don't have a preference one way or another. I'm comfortable with it being in there or comfortable without it.
It's up to you and Senator Scogin. If Senator Scogin wants it inserted, we can put it in. And you don't necessarily have to decide right now, because we're going to lay this over and for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. But let us know, because sometimes matches are good things to have in there as far as getting the full ball of wax.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll discuss that with Ms. Carpenter, and we'll get back to you.
Okay. Are there any questions of the committee? Seeing none, then we'll lay Senate File 717 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus economic development bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
Senator Olson. You don't have to buy a round. You've been here all around.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm very happy to be here with members of the Walker area community and a representative on behalf of half of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. I'm asking for your support of Senate File 708, which is for a Walker partial funding of the Walker area community center. This is a project in total that has in excess of $4 million project. and we're asking for the state to contribute $650,000 to this very worthwhile project. The center will serve a wide variety of uses for the Walker area, and I'm going to be asking Mr. Mitch Loomis, who is the president of the board of directors for the Walker Area Community Center, to give you the history of the project and explain briefly what this will do for the Walker community. Following his testimony, Ms. Gloria Dudley will specifically talk about the Boys and Girls Club and the agreement between the Walker Area Community and the Leech Lake Band.
Mr. Loomis, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mitch Loomis. I'm the volunteer president of the Walker Area Community Center Board. It's a project that's been underway for many years, 7 years in fundraising. Construction started recently. You may have heard something about that. There was a potential archaeological find that is debatably the largest, oldest find in Minnesota of man-made tools. That's under study. That brought some attention to our project, but the road and the building is under construction now. As Senator Olson said, it's slightly more than a $4 million project. As I said, we were working on fundraising for 7 years. We've raised more than $2.7 million in private funding. So we are three-quarters of the way there in private funding. The building is one half ice arena, and like many ice arenas that serve rural outstate areas, there will be ice in there only in the wintertime, and it will provide a large community space 7 months out of the year. There's space dedicated to the Boys and Girls Club Leech Lake chapter. I believe Ms. Dudley will speak about that a little bit. They serve a broad area on the Leech Lake Band. And then there's a fitness and recreation center in the community center. The operating budget, as we continue capital fundraising and hopefully come to success with that, totality with that, we can operate the building for $250,000 per year. Two-thirds of that would be earned income, one-third from memberships, fitness memberships, and one-third from rental of the ice. And then the other third would come 15% from fundraisers. We've had a golf tournament going on for 4 years and a polar plunge during the Opout Festival that's been going on for 4 years. So, you know, ongoing fundraisers would be part of that operations. And then the remaining 15% would be support from local government. The city of Walker and five townships in that area of the state have all pledged support to the operations of the project.
Do they take a sauna before they take the plunge, or do they just take the plunge?
We'd invite you to come and try it, Senator Tomassoni.
No. I know better. Are there any famous hockey players from Walker?
I think there's famous hockey players from all parts of Minnesota. Mark Parrish has nieces and nephews in the area, and so does Brad Bombardier.
Okay. All right. Okay, who's next?
Okay.
Mr. Chair, my name is Gloria Dudley. I'm a member of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, and I'm here as a representative from our band. I'm the Planning Division Director, and I am here to support the community center, the Walker Area Community Center. The Leech Lake Band has supported this community center activity from their inception, and they have supported them in many ways, many activities, and through donations and being a part of fundraising activities also. One of the activities that Leech Lake Band has going on right now is building a community center in one of our communities, the community of Bena, and that building will be going up in the spring, and we've been working very hard on that, so we know how it is to pursue a community center. 2 years ago, the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe entered into an agreement with the Boys and Girls Club. We have dedicated ourselves to working together and collaboratively because of the fact that one of the target issues in our community is the youth. And by working with the Boys and Girls Club, this is going to help to provide more services to our youth and in all of our communities on the reservation. And I think we have 14 communities within the boundaries of the reservation, and Walker encompasses a lot of the area of youth that are part of our band, and we have positive working relationships with many of the people in Walker, and in pursuing this, it's going to be a great service to our youth and to the community. So I'm here officially to support this project.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I would just add that this community center really is critical to this community. As you know, as most of us know, if we've been to Walker, this is really a destination location for tourism. And this is going to provide an impetus for economic development for this community, which is really very much needed there. In recent years, there's been a number of small businesses that have gone out of business, and so this is going to be very helpful to that community in drawing tourism in to the area. And there's also an identified need for a location for the Boys and Girls Club, who do wonderful things for the youth in our area, and provide something, a need that isn't otherwise being met. So this is really encompasses both of those needs, and I think is critical to this community. So again, I very much ask for your support for a project that has nearly reached the level of funding that will help it to become successful. If we can give it a little more support at the state level, I think we'll ensure its success.
And Senator Olson, maybe I wasn't listening closely earlier, but you have this one paragraph in the overview about the $25,000 for planning and then a $400,000 challenge grant. So was that money was matched, I take it, the $400,000. And then there's another $1.2 million cash and about $600,000 in pledges. And that's the money you'd be using for pledging this $650,000 that's, or for matching this $650,000 that's in the request in the bill, correct?
Yes, actually, Senator Tomassoni, this project was over $4 million. It was $4,700,000 total dollars. There were $407,000.
$4,007,000.
Okay. And all of that has been met through either in-kind donations with construction and interior. Some of that was in-kind, but the rest of it has actually been cash donations that have been raised either from direct contributions or from grants that have been obtained from the people who have been working on this project. So they're really only asking for the state to donate what would amount to less than 20% of the overall cost of the project.
Okay. Not very greedy at all.
No.
Senator Koch.
And they're not asking you to rely on them doing this in the future. They have actually already put the effort into this. So.
Okay, Senator Koch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Olson, I'm just wondering what the local government, the city's contribution has been. I know you mentioned that they are going to be involved with the ongoing operating funds, but what kind of dollars are they putting in?
Mr. Chair, Senator Koch, they've put a great deal of money into developing the infrastructure to get to this building because it's at a fairly remote location at the top of a hill on the outskirts of the city. And so what they have done is put a lot of money into developing that infrastructure into the road, which is what we were talking about when we said we had the archaeological find. So I guess that's been their primary contribution. Would you like to address that further?
A road has been built to serve the community center. The water and sewer is in to that point. This is new geography that this road is going into. And the city has put $132,000 into that beyond the assessment of the properties that are served by that road. That's just one example. The city's been at the table all the way through. Pam Worth is one of our city councilors and been very involved and supportive.
Ms. Worth, would you like to add to the discussion here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I was just recently elected to the city council, so this is my first experience with government, but I'm really enjoying it, and I really am enjoying the Capitol. The city is behind this project. The mayor actually broadcast live from our last polar plunge and was very supportive of it. And so I think that we will continue to get support from the city as the project goes on.
Did the mayor plunge?
The mayor had to decline. He's not in real good health, is what he said.
The old health excuse. Does anybody else have anything to say? Senator Kubley?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm a little curious. This looks like a good bonding project. Is there a reason we're not seeking to have it bonded as opposed to general fund?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kubley, after consulting with Senator Langseth, he suggested that we put it in this format and hope for the money this year, and then we'll see what happens from there.
Okay. Thank you.
See how that works? Okay. Does anybody else have anything to add? You have one more person there. Do you want to?
Yeah, Mara did actually plunge, so if you want to know what it felt like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mara Loomis. I am a parent of two children in the Walker area, and being behind this project and putting my heart into the project, knowing that it's so needed, we appreciate anything that the state can do to help the youth in our entire Leech Lake area. Thank you for taking the time for listening to us.
And you did plunge?
I did plunge.
And how long did you stay under?
I don't stay out long. I get out as fast as I can.
Okay. Any further questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair, if you plunge, I'll pay money to see
Senator
it. So there's a fundraising.
It all depends on
they can raise funds.
It all depends on how much you pay, because I just might do it. I might donate it. Okay.
I'll send pledge forms.
Oh, yeah. Senator Fischbach. Okay. Are there any further comments? Senator Olson, no?
Just okay. That we'd love to see you all there to see the completed project.
Okay. All right. Then we'll lay Senate File 708 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus economic development bill. So thank you all very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Saxhog, you want to go next?
Yeah.
Then it's all Sparks Day after that.
That's when I got a goal.
Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Today I'm presenting Senate File 21. This bill will appropriate about $30 million in bonds for the infrastructure needed for Itasca County to build a proposed steel plant on the western Mesaba Iron Range. With me today is former State Senator Ron Dicklich, who's also the legislative liaison for Itasca County, and Howard Hildhorst, who is the representative.
Executive Vice President.
He's Executive Vice President for Minnesota Steel. And they're going to help me answer any questions the committee might have on this particular project.
Mr. Dicklich.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this is kind of phase two, if you will have it. Last year, Itasca County brought the legislature a proposal for $53 million of bonding to provide infrastructure that would serve a Minnesota Steel, which is a $1.6 or $1.7 billion proposed steel project in Itasca County, and that includes a mine, taconite plant, direct reduced iron facility, and electric arc furnace that would produce in excess of 2.5 million tons of steel. We were successful in getting up to about $23 million, $12 million in bonding, and another $11 million in appropriation, which is overseen by the by DEED, Department of Economic Development. Employment and Economic Development. Currently, we are in the process of doing the pre-design, preliminary and pre-design of the rail, the gas pipeline, electrical, and some roads that are a result of the roads having to be shut down to serve the steel plant. And under industrial laws and rules, you can't have roadways in that area. And so this is this $30 million request would be what would be needed to complete the rail, the gas line, and the electrical facilities that would be needed to serve this electric arc furnace, which uses about 600 megawatts of electricity, and some of the road reroutes that are necessary for that project. I guess with that, as Senator Saksak said, Mr. Hillsource, who is Executive Vice President of Minnesota Steel, can give you an update, as this money would only be used in the event of a financial close, which they are working very diligently on and making great strides to having that happen. Currently, I'm working with Deed. In fact, Mr. Nelson, who's the project manager, is here in the audience today. If you have any questions about the first grant that Itasca County was awarded, as we were allowed to use $4 million to do preliminary costs before financial close because of the timing and the length of time it would take to get the rail and gas line in. You're talking a couple of years. And based on when they would need it, their financial close, it comes sometime after that, the time that we needed to start to get through our permitting process. We're currently having permitting issues with the Surface Transportation Board in Washington, D.C., and also with the gas line, we have to go through the Public Utilities Commission in Minnesota.
Mr. Hillhorst, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here.
Let's hear an update.
Just that simple.
Say your name for the record so Laura knows.
My name is Howard Hillhorst. I'm the Executive Vice President for Minnesota Steel. The project is very well developed and very far along. We have our draft EIS out. It was noticed on February 12th. The public comments will close in early April. There will be a DNR PCA Corps of Engineers public hearing in Nashwauk on March 14th. Once the draft EIS is completed, all public comments are included, then the final EIS will be developed and placed on display again. Once that is done, the permits will be placed on display, public display. We are anticipating that sometime in early summer, June, July time frame, that the permits will be finalized and issued, and immediately after that we will have our financial close. Our finances are in very good condition. We have a consortium of three worldwide banks who are providing the debt portion of our project, which is $1.1 billion. And we also have a equity investor whom I cannot name at this point, but an equity investor we're in very significant negotiations with and are coming to a conclusion. So by the end of this spring, this project will be ready to go.
And what are we looking at as far as construction jobs and then permanent jobs afterwards?
Nothing will happen until financial close, yeah, and we gain our permits. Once that occurs, then we anticipate beginning to construct almost immediately. So if close is in July of this year, well, I hate to say it a heartbeat later, but very close to that, we'll start constructing the project. It's a two-year construct. We're anticipating producing steel sometime in the early in the latter half of 2009.
And then how many jobs do we have during the construction phase, and then how many permanent jobs after?
The construction jobs will peak out at about 2,000. So there'll be a lot of people working. We will begin to hire our own employees sometime The permanent employees will probably come on board sometime in 2008. We have not finalized that aspect of it yet. There will be a phase one, phase two, a full two-phase, phase two, I'm sorry. There'll be about 700 jobs developed by this project, permanent local jobs. There will also be an additional 2,100 flow-on or support jobs around the community, around the state.
Have we figured out what kind of steel we're going to be making yet? I mean, is that...
We'll be making, in phase one, for certain, we will be producing slab steel.
Okay.
Slab is anywhere from 8 to 10 inches thick, 44 to 96 inches wide, and anywhere from 12 to maybe 30 feet long. Very high quality, large chunk of steel.
And these are electric arc furnaces. I don't know if you all know about that, but at any rate, it's really good stuff. And
yes,
is there the potential? Because my next step on this, I think, is that we start manufacturing the Maytag washers and the Toro and the Toro lawnmowers. And so, is there a possibility to make that type of steel out of that plant in phase two?
We will be making automotive quality steel,
okay,
which is the highest grade possible.
Okay. All right. So, Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I might just say something about the effort that's gone into this project already by city, county, state, and even some private concerns. The three major projects leading up to what we hope will be the financial closing were, first of all, a large land exchange that involved how many thousand acres?
7,000 acres.
7,000 acres in the area where the mining is going to be done. And it was owned, the service rights were owned by the Blanham Paper Company. The Blanham Paper Company elected to exchange with Itasca County that amount of land, and consequently Itasca County came in possession of the land over the potential mining site, and they, of course, will then sell it to Minnesota Steel, sell or lease, whatever works out. So that was a huge piece of this whole thing. The environmental impact statement, as Vice President Hillhorst said, was a very key piece of this whole thing, and we think that this particular point, the DNR and the MPCA deserve a lot of credit for the work that they've done in putting that out as quickly as possible. And finally, this whole infrastructure, certainly the state is participating, but the local units of government, a couple of cities around the area, are participating heavily too, along with Itasca County. So we think it's some real teamwork has gone into this, and it's going to be a potentially huge boon for the Western Mesaba Iron Range.
And to refresh my memory, how much land will we be mining that is actually University Trust land that will be generating lease money to the state of University of Minnesota?
The project is a long-term project. It's about a 100-year project. Over that 100 years, it will be approximately 2,300 acres of mineral owned by the state that will go into the University Trust Fund.
So it's another significant amount of money coming to the university also.
Yes.
Is there a school trust land there or just University Trust land?
There is both.
Senator Dicklich.
And Mr. Chair, I believe in the first 10 years, that's when most of the trust fund, I think it's upward of 35% to 40% of that mined will be both state school trust and university trust fund lands. So of the first 10 years, a huge amount of that is it will be paid royalties.
Okay. So is there any questions of the witnesses or Senator Saxon? It's a very good project. I hope can get this thing done. Keep going forward. And congratulations. It's going well. We'll lay this over. We'll have to do a letter of recommendation to the bonding committee, and I think you go there next with this, right, Senator Saxon?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you very much. Senator Sparks.
Senator Metzen.
I'm sorry.
Senator Sparks, Senate File 942?
Actually, Mr. Chair, I think we'll take up Senate File 167 first, if that's okay with you.
Oh, I see. Oh, yeah. Okay. Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 167 is the unemployment insurance bill. This is our third stop, our third committee stop, Mr. Chair and members, but we're glad to be here today, and we'll talk a little bit about this bill. For those members that were here last year, this was the same bill that passed the Senate 62-0 last year. It had a little opposition or a little problem in the House and wasn't able to become law. But the bill is a consensus product of the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council, which is made up of the AFL-CIO, the Teamsters, State Chamber of Commerce, the National Federation of Independent Businesses, Mechanical Contractors Association, Jobs Now Coalition, and Legal Aid. We do have, Mr. Chair and members, a fiscal note that the Chair had requested. The bill is overall cost neutral and actually has some net savings. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will turn it over to Mr. Lee Nelson. He's the Director of Unemployment Insurance Legal Affairs.
Welcome, Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if I might go through this bill very quickly. This bill at Article 1, Section 1 provides for coverage for new labor market entrants by providing an alternate base period of the last four completed quarters. So it will cover about 2,400 workers who do not now qualify for unemployment benefit coverage. This bill also changes the appeal period on everything but review by the Minnesota Court of Appeals from the current 30 calendar days down to 20 calendar days. What we have found, our statistics back in my office will show, that applicants appeal right away, but employers have this unfortunate tendency to wait to file appeals. If we can get employers to file a little quicker, we will get to the cases quicker. We believe this particular provision will save the trust fund $750,000 a year in overpayments. Minnesota has a very long appeal period comparing to most states. Only seven other states have a similar appeal period. Wisconsin has 14-day appeal period. So we are simply asking to go to a 20 calendar day. I should tell you, for about 40 years of this program's history, there was a 7-day appeal period. Then it went to 15 days until about 5 years ago it went to 30. Now you can file an appeal by internet. You can file an appeal by phone. It is a lot easier to file an appeal. We think a shorter appeal period and the savings to the trust fund are worth it. And legal aid and other interest groups are very much in favor, because this bill also requires that we list the exact day and date the determination will become final. So it is in, we think that will be helpful to parties who don't realize that there are 31 days in a month sometimes. This bill is overall cost neutral, as Senator Sparks indicated, because it does reduce from 45% to 43% of the state's average weekly wage, the calculation based on a high quarter. Most people's calculation is not based on a high quarter. But this will freeze for 2 years certain people's benefits who are in disproportion to their annual wage. Let's say that you got a bonus in one period or worked a lot of overtime or had a second job over the Christmas season. Sometimes you can get an inflated weekly benefit amount in relation to your annual wage. This would cap those people from getting what we call an inflated weekly benefit amount. So it makes the bill overall cost neutral. This bill makes applicants who have a outstanding fraud overpayment balance ineligible for benefits until they pay back what they have fraudulently obtained in benefits. Currently, you can go right back into the system and use it to help offset your penalty. We don't feel that you should be able to come back and use the system that you just cheated. This would be the same as Virginia and Utah currently have. This bill will treat holiday pay the same as we're asking for a change in deductible earnings, making it partially deductible rather than the current 100% deductibility for holiday pay. This bill also provides for a new exception to quitting employment. Normally, you're disqualified from benefits if you quit unless you fall under one of 8 exceptions. Now there will be 9. That would be if you have a child care problem, provided that you have attempted to obtain child care, requested accommodation from the employer, and the employer can make no accommodation because of various things with their business. So it would be if you lose your child care and all of a sudden you don't have anything Some people turn around and quit. A smart employee, if they'd have called me, I would have advised them to simply not report for work. Just call in and say, I can't report for work, and if you were fired, you'd collect. But if you happen to have quit, you would be denied. This would provide an exception for those individuals. This law also would provide for an unemployment law judge the discretion to dismiss an appeal if the appealing party doesn't show up. Currently, they have to hold a hearing for if the responding party participates and issue a full decision, even though the appealing party has decided to abandon the appeal. This would be consistent with what most other states do. This bill also provides that all monetary ineligibility and disqualification determinations which result in an overpayment incorporate the overpayment into the determination. Currently, we issue a determination of denial, then we will later issue a determination which will say, oops, we paid you, and then we determined you were denied, now you're overpaid. This will incorporate both of them within the same document. The biggest change in this bill is that it provides for a change in how we would deduct part-time earnings while you're collecting benefits. Currently, after a certain point in time, there is a dollar-for-dollar deduction if you're working part-time while requesting unemployment benefits. That's a disincentive to work. We believe there should be an incentive to work part-time, so we're asking that only part of your part-time earnings be deducted, 55%. 45% would not be deducted, thus providing an incentive to take a part-time job while collecting benefits. This bill also provides for no deduction from unemployment benefits for earnings from service in the National Guard or a military reserve unit. This would be individuals who may be unemployed, who are reservists, who report 1 weekend a month. Current law, that makes it 100% deductible. This would provide no deductibility at all for any military part-time earnings. Those are the most significant provisions of the particular bill. I can go into the depth of it for quite a while if somebody wants to get into it, but those are the significant changes in this bill.
You want to do every page? Not all of us, but some of us have heard this a couple of times and passed, I think, 65 to nothing last year, and I don't – the beauty, I think, of this kind of legislation, it's your business and labor, and it's that unemployment group that's certainly bipartisan, you know, has worked on this. And so I think any time you can get labor and business and that – well, how many member – a commission is that again?
Six. Actually, about 20 members total.
And to do all the hard work that goes into something like this, you're to be commended, or the commission is their committee. Yeah, Mr. Nelson.
Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, this bill did pass all House committees unanimously last year, got hung up on the House floor for reasons totally unrelated to the bill. Representative Mahoney wanted to amend the bill with an apprenticeship program, and that was not allowed to come up for a vote. Representative Mahoney is now carrying this bill, sponsoring the bill in the House, and has assured us he will not do that again. So I just wanted to make that clear.
All right. Any questions? The UI group spent, I don't know how long, molding this thing or bringing it together and make a pretty good comprehensive bill out of it. So unless the committee members have any questions, I think that's fine. What do we do, counsel or anybody? Do we, for inclusion in the big, no, this is a standalone, it's not really a money thing, is it? Did Senator Thomas only want this laid over? Did I hear? I don't know why, but all right, let's do that anyway. And then if he decides in a couple days or something, we could just lift it right up and send it to the floor. But in the meantime, we'll lay the bill over and recommend it pass and then lay it over? Okay.
Sounds good, Mr. Chair and members.
All right. Thank you very much. Senator Sparks, now are we going to do Senate File 942?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that would be correct. We're going to change gears a little bit. These are two very important bills as well. And in fact, we might discuss them because they are related, Mr. Chair. Senate File 942 and Senate File 943 are both appropriation bills that deal with the Rural Policy and Development Center. Just a little background. I know members in your packets, you have a folder with some of the information in it that you can look through. But the Center for Rural Policy and Development was established by the Minnesota State Legislature in 1997 as a public-private partnership to provide policymakers with objective, nonpartisan information on issues relevant to rural Minnesotans and their communities. Over the years, the center has developed a national reputation for accurate, unbiased analysis and evaluation. Recognized by the USDA as the rural voice in Minnesota, the center works in cooperation with national and state organizations to broaden their knowledge of rural policy issues. If you take a look in the packet, you'll see some of the signature products that they have. There's a Rural Minnesota Journal that I would encourage members to take a look at. It's got some very helpful information in it. The Atlas of Minnesota Online, the Rural Minnesota Forum, and the Rural Minnesota Radio Program, Mr. Chair and members. The two appropriation bills in front of you, one is for ongoing appropriations of $500,000 for fiscal year 08 and for $500,000 for fiscal year 09. And Senate File 943 would just restore $2 million of the endowment money that was taken away during some budget crisis. With me today, Mr. Chair and members, is Dr. Jack Gallagher. He's the president of the Center for Rural Development, Rural Policy and Development, and I'll let him testify at this time, if that's all right with you, Mr. Chair.
That's fine. Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jack Geller. I'm president of the Center for Rural Policy and Development in St. Peter, Minnesota. As Senator Sparks said, the center was created in 1997 by the legislature to basically serve as a resource to policymakers. And when I say policymakers, I'm really talking about not only state legislators, but county commissioners, local officials, to provide data and information on the economic and social factors that impact rural Minnesotans and the communities they reside in. The center is a unique organization. We're totally nonpartisan. We don't lobby. Our goal is to provide policymakers and rural leaders with information that is accurate, unbiased, and, as we say, politically unspun. There's really no other organization that's doing what we're doing in Minnesota. For example, in Minnesota today, we know more about the adoption and diffusion and utilization of high-speed internet technology throughout rural Minnesota to a greater extent than any other state does. And the reason why is, since 2001, the center has been collecting that information and disseminating it year after year after year. So we have a good, strong, longitudinal record. Another example, in 2003, then-Senate Majority Leader Hottinger asked the center to take a good look at the new JobZ program that had just recently passed. As you know, we've issued five reports over the years on JobZ, not to suggest that it's a good program or a bad program, but rather to give policymakers good, accurate, unbiased information so you can make your own decisions and your own independent evaluations regarding the program. The new Rural Minnesota Journal that we started last year has really taken off. And again, it's our effort to provide good objective information about issues that are important to rural Minnesota's future. And finally, as Senator Sparks said, we've created an online atlas that can tell you for every county in the state and every school district everything from the percentage of people without health insurance to childhood vaccination rates to the percentage of eighth graders who pass the basic skills test in math. And it's all free at no cost to the end user. But of course, you know that it really isn't free. In fact, it costs quite a bit. As you may know, our state contribution has significantly declined over the years. Actually, we were created in 1997, and today the state contribution to the center is actually 43% of what it was in 1997. Not in inflated dollars, but in real dollars. And while the state contribution has continued to decline to the center over the years, our commitment to rural Minnesota has actually been increasing. We're doing more and more each year and being asked to do more and more because, as I said, we're a unique organization, and if we don't do it, it just doesn't get done. We're currently planning next year to initiate a new biennial report on the status of rural Minnesota to give policymakers and leaders across the state a real comprehensive look as to what rural Minnesota looks like and what the trends are. In many ways, we've become the state's de facto rural affairs department. And while we're not suggesting that the state should create a rural affairs department, I think you would agree that there should be some place in state government that would support this kind of work for the 80 counties that reside outside of the 7-county metro. I also want to be clear that we're not asking you to fully fund our center. But as a public-private partnership, we're asking you to increase your contribution. Our budgets continue to increase while the state contribution continues to decrease. And as many of you know, we have strong relationships with the Blanin Foundation, the Bush Foundation, the McKnight Foundation, the Otto Bremer Foundation. But it becomes harder and harder to convince the private sector that the information we're providing is important to policymakers, both rural and urban, as their contribution continues to decline. So we're asking you to up your contribution. Lastly, regarding the $2 million that Senator Sparks spoke of, understand that this money that was appropriated to us back in 1997 was not money to be spent. It was an endowment that was provided to the center. When the state asked for that money to be returned, all $2 million was there because it was not our intent to spend it. Our intent was to invest it. When you take away an organization's endowment, you're taking away an organization's future. Our goal is to take that $2 million, if you're good enough to give it to us back, and grow it to $10 million. And at that point, we're able to generate enough revenue off that endowment to actually start funding operations in a reasonable way. So if you see fit to provide us with that one-time appropriation of $2 million to restore the money that was taken away back in 2003-2004, we have no intention of spending it. It will be placed in our endowment for growth and basically give us back our future. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
But $2 million would be the 943, the endowment bill, and the other one is for $500,000.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Out of the general fund. And that was at 350 not too many years ago?
That's right.
It was cut down to 150 last year or the year before?
And we've been, Mr. Chair, we've been at 150 for quite a while. We're very thankful that we are in the governor's base budget. It's just the actual number has...
What's his number, excuse me, Doctor, that the governor has it in his base budget? Is that 150? At least you got it.
Correct, Mr. Chair, 150.
So you are... listed anyway. That's the good news.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
All right. Is there anything else? We'll lay this over for possible inclusion. They're both of them in the bigger bill. Did you want to ask, Mr. Chairman, was there any reason to hold up that Sparks unemployment insurance bill that passed? Did you want to look at that for a while?
Yeah. You didn't pass it out here, did you?
No.
Okay.
No. All right. Any announcements or anything?
Are you done with all those
bills? Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
I think we're
okay.
We're done. Meeting's adjourned.